Hello, and welcome to the Thinking Elixir podcast, where we cover the news of the community and learn from each other. My name is Mark Erickson.
I'm Cade Ward.
And I'm David Bernheisel.
Let's jump into the news. First up, Jose Valim teased, I think is probably his most complete tease yet. You know, in other teases he's done, like just like an image, and it's like, you have to guess, and what could this possibly be about? This was like working code.
Yeah.
He says Elixir 1.17 might get a new mix test flag of dash dash breakpoints, or the short version dash B. That's like using breakpoints during tests. And so in a Twitter post, he said, you know, what if you could pass a simple flag of dash B or dash dash breakpoints and then debug every failed test line by line? In Elixir 1.17, you might. So I don't know what the state of this is, if it's just been something that's being explored or at what point in the approval process it is, but we'll have to wait and see. But he included a GIF demonstrating how this would actually work. So it shows you run mixed test, it runs a whole suite of tests, and one of them fails. And then he runs IEX-S mixed test, dash dash failed, dash dash breakpoints. So that would say only rerun my failed test, but he's also running it within IEX-S mix. So it's like running in an IEX session. It's not just mixed test. And then breakpoints. And it looks very much like a Pry debugging session that steps through the failing test. And I thought that looked pretty cool. Because like whenever I get into that point where, why is this failing? Why is this test? I'm trying to debug it. I'm doing all these print statements in different places. And just having something like that that's just a dash B to start breakpoint debugging. And then he said it would also work with other features, like you could do a colon and a line number if you wanted to go for a specific test. I'm looking forward to that one.
That'd be pretty cool. I use Vim, and I have a bunch of little key bindings to like run this specific test or something, run this whole test file, run my whole test suite, run this specific line. So I'm used to doing that, but like, I guess that could work out. I open up a floating terminal, and then it feeds the command in there and goes, but I don't run it with IEX, you know, script mode. So that way I could do the Pry session. That could be pretty cool. I wonder how they're doing that. I wonder if it only works because of like the assert macro. And so the assert macro is just going to like check if it's a failure and this flag is here. And then if so, Pry automatically, you know, I could imagine that being pretty simple. But if it's like just any exception that happens in there, like that would be probably a deeper change. Like, is this change in Elixir? Sounds like it. Or is it in XUnit, which ships with Elixir?
Right.
Yeah. Very nifty.
Not enough details to tell you.
Yeah. All right, next up, speaking of language improvements, we got a Gleam 1.0. So we hadn't talked about that the RC had gone out, kind of took me by surprise, didn't realize we were this close. And now the real thing is out. 1.0 has been released. It's the first stable release of the version of the language. Version 1 is a statement about Gleam's stability and readiness to be used in production systems. So if you've been waiting for that signal, now it is here. Gondor has lit the beacons. With 1.0, the Gleam project is committing to maintain backwards compatibility as well, right? That's the whole Semver thing. So they commit to making every effort to ensure that Gleam does not introduce breaking changes. So congrats to Louis Pilfold and his team, all the contributors to that. If you don't know what Gleam is a compiled language that compiles down to the Erlang bytecode. It also compiles to JavaScript for that matter, but the differentiating feature of Gleam versus Elixir is that it introduces types. And there's so much work into introducing types because the implications of that is that he has to add like types to all the OTP things too, like gen server, you know, like all those things that don't have types. So there's a lot of work that goes into that. So if you really appreciate types and the language is built for it from the ground up, Gleam is definitely worth considering. There's plenty of examples of interoperability between Gleam and Erlang and even Elixir. So very good language. Go check it out.
And next up, last week we talked with Philip Brown, and in that discussion, the idea of debugging and getting observability type of logging information and stuff like that was being discussed. And David, you mentioned this idea of tracing, but I think you were talking about something different than what Lars actually announced. So Lars Wiekmann announced that he had been playing with tracing and had some projects to share. So this is two libraries he released. One's called ntrace, E-N-T-R-A-C-E, and the other is a Ntrace Live Dashboard. So this is doing beam tracing where you're in a runtime system and you're saying execute this function like as a tuple of module function and arguments that you're passing in, and then it does a beam trace of giving you insights to what's actually happening in the runtime system. And then with the handy Live Dashboard plugin page to make that easier to do, to run those traces there. So I thought that was really cool. And I thought when I saw that, I was like, oh, tracing. Uh-huh. It's the same word, but it's a different thing.
Not to add to the confusion, you know, of all the things out there. You got metrics, you got logs, you got tracing, and that's in the world of open telemetry or just observability, really. And then you have like beam tracing, like what this library is doing, which is typically, I think folks familiar with this would be looking at something like Redbug, I think. Can't remember the other one, but there's another one. These are Erlang libraries, and they're designed for you to be in an IEX session, you know, a terminal, like to tracing these things. And I think just that the UX of tracing is just not very inviting, you know? Large companies would just completely keel over if they knew that any developer could IEX into their production system, right? So usually console sessions into your running code is a big no-no anyway. But those that do have it, it's still a bit tedious to do it anyway. So Ntrace seems to be a very nice UX wrapped up into enabling live observability via beam tracing into your running system. So that's very cool. All right, last up, we got ElixirConf US announcement. A week or two ago, they announced that the training CFP was open. So now we're moving on to the next part of this, which is the speaker CFP. So if you are thinking about giving a talk, you should develop your idea, write a synopsis, and pitch it. And so there is a Google form. We've got a link here. You'll also find it on their website, I'm sure. And the dates for this, the speaker CFP is open today, or actually yesterday, March 4th through the 31st. So you have all month of March to get your ideas percolating and synopsised, at least. If you're curious of when that conference would be, if you get your talk selected, what your commitment would be, it would be August 28th and 30th, at least in person, in Orlando, Florida, at SeaWorld. So get your ideas going. You can be a serial CFPer and get like five of them going and submit all five and then get in real trouble if all five of them are selected.
And then you have to be in two different rooms at the same time.
Yeah. But we're at that stage now where you can deepfake yourself and just have your AI personality give the other talk. So possible.
Yeah, just as a reminder, if you're new to giving conference talks, one of the great ways to do it is to get involved with meetups. And, you know, even if you're going to give a conference talk, you can pair the talk and give it as a practice at a meetup. It could be a virtual meetup or an in-person one. But definitely getting involved at those local meetups can be a great way to build up some of that experience too.
Definitely. Good suggestion. Did that myself. Completely changed the later half of my talk. So worth it.
Yes. And that's it for the news. Elixir and Phoenix are incredible. They make it possible to quickly build highly resilient and reliable systems capable of operating at incredible scale. Fly.io is a great place to host Elixir apps. You can deploy your app to multiple regions around the world with a private network linking them all together, so your app can cluster and globally do some incredible Phoenix magic. Give your users a more responsive UI while writing less code and moving the app closer to your users without needing an ops team. Check out fly.io for your next Elixir app. Today, we're being joined by our special guest, Dave Lucia. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again, Mark and David.
Yes, we were checking on it, and we've had you on this show for three times now. So you're, I think, the only other guest who's been on more is Jose. I think that's the case.
And mostly because Jose did like a series with us too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll have to get Jose like a robe like they do on SNL or something.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. All right. So we've talked to you before about RabbitMQ and Commanded, Avro and Elixir, time series data with timescale DB. And so now we're taking a little bit of a different tack. So this is third episode in our little mini series where we're talking about all the other stuff around the Elixir system that helps support the team and the business. All the things that we're going to talk about, none of them are paid endorsements. We are just interested in learning what works for different companies at different sizes and where they are today. Because one of the things I was mentioning is, you know, I've worked at lots of different companies. I've never been at a company where we're just like, this is perfect. There's no room for improvement. It was always like, this is good enough for today. You know, this will get us by. And I think that's okay, right? We don't need to feel shame for that because I think we're all doing that to some degree. And what I find valuable and is enlightening for me is to hear what is working for other people for their, I don't know, it's like almost like MVP of making this work for where I am today for our team. And I'm really excited to just talk with you, Dave, about what you've been seeing and doing and what types of systems you're having exposure to and hearing kind of your experiences there. So, but before we get into all that, I'd love to hear a little bit more about you. Like, where do you live and what kind of work are you doing?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm really excited to get into all of that. And I've been enjoying the series myself so far. Again, my name is Dave Lucia. I've been running Elixir in production since 2016. So I think coming up on 8 years now, and this is my fourth company using Elixir as the predominant language that powers the company. I live right outside of New York City in Long Island, New York, in a little town called Syosset. And got two little kiddos and two little dogs here who will hopefully stay quiet for the next hour.
All right. Well, Dave, maybe you could give us a little bit of a intro as to the types of companies that we're talking about, the solutions that you're thinking of. Like, are these small, like bootstrapped, like single person, or are these medium-sized companies to very large enterprise-y? Like, what have you been having most exposure to?
We're going to focus on the last four companies I've been at, and these range from teeny tiny startups of, you know, four people to getting into the medium sized company range of 100 to 200 plus people, Series C and D type startups, but mostly pretty small.
That's where a lot of my professional experience has been as well, is in the smaller to medium sized companies. And then as the companies would get really big, then I was like, this doesn't feel the same.
So my career started out at Bloomberg, and
wow, yeah, that's big.
It is fundamentally different to work at a big company and work at a startup. When you're in a big company, you're always feeling like you're either needing to ask for permission for something or to kind of like, you know, break through a wall to accomplish what you're needing to accomplish. I remember leaving and coming to a small company and feeling like, oh, I don't have to ask anyone for permission to do this simple thing, like go talk at a meetup. That is something I had to get permission for prior, or, you know, work on open source.
Right.
The legal complications and just the bureaucracy at a larger company is just very different. And those aren't necessarily bad things, they're to protect the organization, but they do change how you approach things and even how you choose tools.
Yeah, just like having to, you know, do all this research and make these justifications for why we should try out, do an experiment to try out this particular tool. That can feel very heavy, very. So yeah, now we're talking about like the smaller teams where you've done some research, like, I'm going to just try this out. Then we move forward.
For me, a lot of times I'll see a lot of traction in particular online communities for a tool, and I'll be like, let me give that a try. And if I like it, it's like, let's start a trial on the credit card and let's see how things go. And then, you know, if the $20 subscription is worth it, we'll keep it going. Otherwise, we'll cancel it and move on to something else.
All right. Well, let's jump in then. I'm excited to hear what you've been using. And I'm really also interested in hear if you've been using the same tools at these different places or you've found different things along the way. So let's start with monitoring. That's, I think, one of the big baseline ones that everyone feels they have to have an answer for, right? How do I know when my servers are up or down? And how do I know what's going on with them when exceptions or errors are happening? That kind of stuff. Like, what have you found most helpful there?
There's a lot of ground to cover there. And it has changed so much in the larger tech community, as well as the Beam ecosystem, since I've started my software career. So I'd say the fundamental change that has happened over the last 3, 4, 5 years, I actually don't know when this change started, is the OpenTelemetry initiative. I think it's actually related to the CNCF, but I could be wrong about that. There's an initiative to standardize the way that logs, metrics, and traces are collected in a vendor agnostic way, so that you could run the OpenTelemetry collector as an example. You run that in your infrastructure, you ship your logs and your metrics and your traces to that, and then you just configure where you want to send it. I want to send some of this to Datadog, I want to send some of this to Honeycomb or Lightstep or Grafana Cloud, and this is something that didn't exist before. Prior to a few years ago, if you want to use a vendor, you'd run like a vendor specific SDK. And sometimes those vendor SDKs get really integrated into your project and they're very hard to switch. Other times they're lighter and they're easier to switch out. But the OTel Collector kind of makes this like irrelevant, where you just have one way to instrument your application for the most part. That's actually not true in experience. And then everything just gets shipped out. So you ask, like, what has changed and what is different? For any project, I think the first observability tool that I always install is Sentry. I find that I get a lot of bang for my buck from Sentry more than any other tool, you know, whether it's shipping logs somewhere to like PaperTrail or, you know, even getting metrics out of the box. Just getting those errors cataloged so I can then go and create tickets for them or just keep track of like what is going wrong in my project. I feel like I get a lot of mileage out of that, especially early on when there's a lot of rapid iteration in a project. The downside I found with Sentry is, particularly with Elixir, is supervisors and Sentry are not a good match. If you get in a crash loop, your Elixir app's going to stay up, but your Sentry subscription is not.
You all of a sudden have 30,000 exceptions.
Yeah, this happened to me like a few months ago. I just paid for Sentry. Like I just put the credit card down and over the weekend, it was like a holiday weekend, my app generated like 2 million Sentry errors. And Sentry has like a spike protection feature, but it didn't fire for some reason. And it was fun. I actually ended up getting on a Zoom call with their product team and they were like showing me their new tools and why it didn't catch and kind of talking through the use case. They've got a great team over there, but yeah, you could really burn through your quotas real fast with Elixir supervisors and the Beam supervisors. So be careful.
And kind of similarly, the live view process can also aggressively remount and retry things as well.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to chew through your observability quotas. I've done the same thing on Honeycomb and Lightstep, which are particularly a tracing tool. I've been using Lightstep. We started using it at SimpleBet. And this is to get very specific data out of your system where you can annotate spans roll up into a trace. You know, if I hit a web server, the first span that I'll see is like the route span, which might have some like user agent information, the route that you're hitting, everything else. But then underneath that, like each ecto query is going to be a span and those will be linked. And you could link calls to different processes, different servers. You make an HTTP call. And what's amazing about this is that you get this beautiful time graph of kind of where is time being spent. So like the classic example with tracing is N+1 queries just look like a big diagonal going down your application. And so this is probably the second tool that I usually integrate and it takes a little bit more effort is integrating the OpenTelemetry collector and then shipping my spans. Well, actually also the OpenTelemetry tracer so that I start to get spans and OpenTelemetry Phoenix and Obin and any of the libraries I'm using, Ecto. This will add default instrumentation, and then that's usually just enough, and I could start sending that over to Honeycomb or to Lightstep. And I tend to prefer Honeycomb these days just because it's so fast, and you can really basically ask it questions about what's happening in my application. You know, some user reports something, I could start searching for spans with their user ID attached to it and, you know, see what's going wrong. Or if there's a, you know, more general reported issue, I could start slicing and dicing it and see if there's any correlations with, you know, a particular service or a particular database or region or whatever it is. So I love having these tracing tools because I can get to the bottom of questions really fast. But those tools are kind of newer.
You mentioned the collector there.
Yeah.
I know that like Sentry, for example, so just error exception reporting, right? Like their hex package is installed. They already have a configuration of where to send those things. But generally the way that works is the exception happens. There might be a ring buffer somewhere to localize that stuff for a bit. And then it sends it up. I'm not even sure if it does buffer it, but it just sends it directly to Sentry over HTTP. OpenTelemetry though, tracing specifically, I don't think has that capability where it's complicated. It can be more complicated. Let me put it that way. So the collector is that other agent that's running alongside your app, and your app sends it like sideways, not over the internet, but to the collector, just locally. which kind of implies that you have some sort of orchestration that might be happening if you're using the collector. Where it gets confusing is that I do think some of these services allow you to ship spans and traces directly over the net too. Do you know much more about that?
So in general, yes, they do. Both Honeycomb and Lightstep, I think, have direct ways to integrate and send stuff over. Datadog as well, like that you might ship it to the agent locally and that ships it over. Mm-hmm. There are direct integrations. However, in the last few years, all of these vendors have committed to OpenTelemetry as a standard and are really trying to push their users to use the OpenTelemetry collector or even just the SDKs so that the way that it's being sent is standardized, and that kind of moves us forward as an industry. I do actually want to highlight something else, though, because you mentioned how spans might get buffered in the OpenTelemetry collector. And this actually comes into like a really interesting topic of sampling. And there's tail sampling and head sampling. And this is like a massive area of research and interest where, you know, you can generate tons and tons, millions of events in your application, but you really only want to pull out like representative samples of data. Otherwise, you're just going to overload the system with events that you don't care about and use up your quota. So there's different solutions to that that could be baked into the OpenTelemetry collector. Honeycomb, I think, has a paid agent that runs, I think, also next to the collector. Could be wrong about that. So it's a complicated topic, but depending on your level of sophistication, might be necessary.
Gotcha. But just having the OTel collector running at all implies that your infrastructure allows for like multiple containers to be deployed at the same time, networked together, that kind of thing. It kind of all depends on your like deployment strategy at that point. With all of your different companies that you've worked at, I'm sure they all have their different like deployment strategies. One place might have had Kubernetes or something, or using Helm charts or something, you know, whatever. And then you got the other side where it's just like, we're just going to do bare EC2. Or you really go the other way and you just go to eBay and find a server and SSH into it and expose it to the internet. You know, OTel collectors kind of like imply a sophistication to how you deploy things. So like, how important is that to you? Where do you put that in your process?
So I actually just checked, and I don't run the OTel collector in my web app.
Oh, uh-huh. All right.
Yeah. And the reason why I'm confused, and we didn't really talk about what I'm up to these days, but at my current company, TV Labs, we're running Elixir in the cloud on fly.io. We've got 4 nodes. I just checked my configuration. We use the OTel exporter and export directly to Honeycomb. So there's no extra infrastructure. It's actually pretty easy to set up. And I have a blog post about this on davelucia.com. So go check it out. That's the easiest way to get started up. And if you don't want to get sophisticated with your infrastructure, you don't have to. No problem. There are added benefits to running the OTel collector, but let's forget about those for a second. I also run, right now, we're about 30-something edge devices. Specifically, we're running NVIDIA Jetsons. And on these, we're running in a Docker container, the OTel collector, that's talking to about 8 local services. They're all pushing spans, and then those go up to Honeycomb. Mm. So rather than configuring each device with API keys for Honeycomb, we just say, hey, go to localhost this or OTel, you know, colon port this in Docker, and those then get shipped from the collector to Honeycomb. So there's one place where you configure it.
Gotcha. Okay, so the lesson I wanted to pull out of here then is that it does not necessarily require you, it depends on everything, right? But it does not necessarily require you to have a complicated infrastructure to support getting traces somehow.
That is correct.
Yeah.
I misspoke. We're getting deep into monitoring, and I love it, or observability, I should say. Two other tools that I've used across different companies that I have love-hate relationships with. Let's go with the one that's more of a hate is Prometheus and Grafana.
Nice.
I've used this at SimpleBet, and I'm using it now at TV Labs. The hate for Prometheus and Grafana come with how metrics are stored and how expensive they are. So you can quickly balloon your metrics bill because you improperly create time series. which brings up the topic of cardinality. So whenever I have a span in tracing with Honeycomb and Lightstep, the key feature there is that I can have high cardinality fields. An example of this is a user ID, where there could be millions of users on my platform, so that the number of possible values is very high. Whereas in metrics, you need to have low cardinality values, because each new value will create a new time series. And because they bill by the number of time series, the more time series you have, the more you're going to pay. That's one reason why metrics are frustrating, is because you can't include kind of the granularity of data you might want. And the other bit is that it is just an absolute pain to configure. But once you have it, it does give you kind of like a nice high level overview of what's happening in your platform. The downside is that you might see CPU spike, but it's not really going to tell you why, and it's not really going to help you answer the question as to why, unless you have a lot of other metrics and time series that you've thought about prior that, you know, might help you answer that question. Whereas tracing, you can kind of ask the system more questions, because you could throw more interesting types of data in and generate graphs on the fly and drill into traces and kind of come up with a root cause analysis much faster. And the last bit is like your classic APMs, application performance monitoring tools. Actually, when I was listening to the episode with Tyler, he mentioned AppSignal, and I actually forgot about AppSignal and how much I loved it. It is a great tool. I don't know why I don't have it in my app, but I think I'm going to install it later today. Just get a lot of great information. Some of it's going to be redundant if you're using these other tools, but man, they just do a great job of surfacing like what's happening in your Phoenix routes as an example. And it's a great place to get started. So probably before you jump to a Lightstep or Honeycomb, get that installed, and that'll probably get you pretty far.
Nice. Well, that was a lot that we just talked about there.
A lot about observability. I want to consider the startup person, you know, where they don't feel as enabled for whatever reason to just put their credit card into all these different services and have possibly ballooning bills on bazillions of high cardinality metrics. How did you make your decision to say that that was worth it compared to like a later company? They have a stable income, they've got a budget, they've got some room in it, you know, like how did you make that decision?
Well, for Honeycomb, it was really easy because their free tier is absurdly generous and I'm not paying them.
Oh,
I plan to. I'm still sending them like 20 million events a month and they're just like, great, you're free. So thank you, Honeycomb. You should probably have a smaller tier so that I could pay you at a place that makes sense. Prometheus and Grafana, it really came down to, I wanted a place to send logs to. So I mentioned we had these edge devices. And there's this piece of software called Promtail, which is not part of Prometheus, but it is in the Grafana family. Basically, it's a Docker container. You throw it on, you know, in Docker Compose or Docker Swarm or Kubernetes, whatever you're using, and it scrapes the Docker logs. And then you could ship that to Loki, which is a log backend that runs in Grafana Cloud. I was like, all right, well, if I'm going to use this and I'm already using Grafana, might as well start shipping metrics there. That's gone okay. I'm not thrilled, but I have more information than I did before. But the challenge there is that unless you want to run Prometheus, Grafana, that whole stack yourself, you're going to run it in Grafana Cloud, and they don't have amazing ways to manage cost. So you could set up alerts, you could view this cost management view, and even now you have ability to like combine metrics after the fact to save you some dollars. But they don't say, hey, if I'm going to spend more than $100, you know, stop collecting. So you can accidentally spend boatloads of money without even realizing it. So I think that's one to be wary of. But then the app signals of the world, like you're going to spend $20 a month, even for Sentry, you're going to spend $20 a month, and you're going to get a lot of value out of that. I don't see how you don't have those kinds of tools. Sentry plus like an APM, I don't get how you don't start there. Because they're just something I couldn't live without. They add so much value to debugging production issues.
One of the questions I want to touch on is, what pieces of information are you really valuing from these tools that say this is worth it to me? So you just mentioned right there that these help you debug production issues. When you're talking about metrics or observability or, you know, just error tracking at a lower level of what is it you really want out of these systems?
I want to be proactive, not reactive, is usually my goal. So these tools in general help me be aware of issues sometimes before they happen, or at least as they happen. The last thing I want is a user to come to us and say, hey, I'm having this issue, and we had no idea about it. So these tools in different ways provide us these signals that come out of our machine, and we can kind of grab them and respond to them immediately rather than reacting to some user or any kind of situation where something might happen and it was reported externally. That's what I want to avoid. And all these tools come at different angles. Some of them can help just capture like high level metrics, and that can even be related to like kind of business initiatives. So as an example, we might want to have a metric that's just like the number of sessions happening right now. And that's something that we could put in Grafana, and we can kind of have like a high level picture of, even at a per organization level in our platform, what's the kind of like shape of traffic that we're seeing today right now. The honeycombs of the world with tracing, you could do some really interesting things and set up alerts where you could say, hey, if there's any route that serves users that is above this latency, send me an alert and configure it so that if the latency spikes over 500 milliseconds, P90, and it happens for longer than 30 seconds, send me an alert. And then I can know, oh, there's an infrastructure issue, or, oh, we actually rolled out a database migration and we didn't put an index on something and we didn't catch it in staging. So Honeycomb would really help diagnose those issues really, really, really fast. And then APM is kind of like a catch-all. It gives me high-level information about what's going on in the app. Kind of is like the in-between of the metric-specific platforms and the tracing-specific platforms. And logs just kind of suck in general, in my opinion.
If you're digging through logs, then you know something bad has happened.
Yeah.
I do want to give a place for them, though, right? You mentioned that traces might be sampled. Metrics might also be sampled. Logs are generally not a sampled thing. So if you're looking for that specific user event or whatever, you know, it might possibly not be there in your traces, but your logs ought to be. I don't know. That probably is like zero help to anybody, because what does that mean? Well, I got to log everything then. I guess I should log everything. But
well, I mean, what I've worked at companies before where when there were particular issues, the events that we were tracking were high value, right? So there wasn't like a huge number of them, but when they happened, they were important. And they were tied to specific individuals, and it was an important matter. And so when something comes up, then, you know, why did this fail? What happened here? Then having the ability and the visibility into the logs to be able to trace exactly what happened to narrow it down. So that means you're putting enough information into your logs. And if you're using metadata or anything like that to help it be filterable or something, you're putting it into a tool to help visualize and sort it by time frames or anything like that. Very helpful.
You know, I just realized that at least in OpenTelemetry and at least in Elixir or so, there is a behavior that I think you can implement for the tracer to determine when to sample this particular event. And so I guess, theoretically, you could say that if this is a telemetry event that is an exception or something, yes, sample it. So that way I get the whole thing. And your logs can still be correlated to that, because I think generally it's correlated with the trace ID or trace parent or whatever. So that should just auto link to your trace, at least in most platforms. Anyway, hey, well, hey, I just solved my own problem, my own question. I'm happy we had this talk.
I want to add two things. One is that you can sample logs, because logs get really expensive as well.
Yeah.
And I've adopted the practice that I learned from Brian Nagley, who is on the observability working group for Erlang, to run at warn level in production. And then only if you're having an incident do you update your logger to say, change the level to debug. And now I can get start pulling out information, and then I could switch it back. The other bit is what you were talking about, David, where I don't know if it's stabilized yet, but you can, as you said, correlate the logs, which are really just events,
yeah,
and see them on the spans. And that's really powerful, but I don't think that the Erlang implementation does that correctly yet. Or at least I haven't configured it correctly, so I'm not sure.
there's certainly some fuzzy areas there. I'm trying to come at it from a Datadog perspective, and I think there's generally, if the metadata there contains trace ID, then their collectors will correlate all of their things together. But who knows what the other platforms are doing or what version of OTel I'm working with or, you know, all that stuff. There's honestly, there's too many moving pieces here to keep it all straight in your head. I think there was even a blog post by, forget their entire name, but Charity, somebody who's involved in...
Charity Majors.
That sounds right, yeah.
She's the CTO of Honeycomb.
Oh, well, very relevant then. I think they just put out a blog post of like, just kind of a lamenting of how the observability products and names for things is just too much. And in particular, they were calling them like wide events or long events or something. But like these platforms have, I don't know, I should just link to the post and let you come to your own conclusions. But what I gathered out of it was don't log anything, don't throw metrics for anything, trace everything. But also traces should be called wide events because these events can like really be all of these things. And we've got too many names for things. So I didn't really gather there was a solution out of here or a proposal. It was just like, this industry be crazy, yo. And that was kind of the whole point.
So Fly.io does sponsor this podcast. And one of the things that's available on the Fly platform is metrics, which are built in. So it has the ability to do Prometheus and Grafana with built-in system dashboards and then custom metrics as well. So you're not paying any extra for those. Just being aware that that is something there to give that level of visibility into like what's going on right now with my system and visualizing that and not having to maintain it.
All right, just self-correction. It wasn't a post by Charity Majors. It included a quote by Charity Majors, though. And the quote is, what's the best logging solution? People asking her. Charity says, logs are trash. We don't keep trash. And the post goes on to how naming things is hard, I guess.
Yes. All right. Well, we need to go on a little bit more if we're going to touch anything else, because we've covered a lot there, which is really great. I really enjoyed all of that. So one of the other things I'm just thinking about is tracking user behavior within the app. And that involves, you know, analytics of what are they doing on the website versus how are users using my application? Are they being successful with it? Are they getting stuck? Any tools or anything that helps you get insight into that kind of a situation?
So I've taken the approach of two different ways. Starting with the Outline, which was now three companies ago, we instrumented the whole front end with Amplitude. So Amplitude is a vendor that specializes in user analytics. You emit events, you can attach arbitrary data to the events, you can associate a user just like once in a session, and then all of the events get associated with that user. And then in their platform, you can visualize all the user data. So you could build funnels to see like, all right, a user logs in, you know, how many of them get to this particular page of my application? And then you can start to, you know, ask more sophisticated questions and build dashboards that can help on the business or sales side of things, answer questions. For the Outline, this is particularly useful when we are trying to measure ad campaigns and see kind of, you know, how many users were seeing this particular ad in this placement, or even just in new features that we're adding to the website, you know, how many times were they being interacted with? What types of users? Where were the users coming from who interacted with this the most? Amplitude is very good at helping us answer those questions. And I've used that in a few companies since, although it's a tool that I tend to add much later. My personal preference is to keep it in-house as much as possible and build custom dashboards in LiveView. An early investment that I try to make in my applications is to build some infrastructure for admin dashboards. So it's like relatively easy to add, you know, a new panel that can show some sort of internal information. I like to build dashboards that just query our database, not even against a Wreath replica, because I'm not building, you know, some crazy analytics query, but just general information like how many people logged in today? For us at TV Labs, we have users who are logging in and checking out TVs. So what was the average session length for today? How many different organizations used a TV and how many people per organization were using a TV? All this is very easy to add into LiveView once you get some reusable components going. a few chart components, you can get some really compelling stuff, and you don't have to pay a vendor to do it, and you don't have to spend an inordinate amount of time maintaining and building these dashboards. So I tend to go that route. And then when I want to get more sophisticated, then you can get into some of the more complicated data and BI tools that you can sink a few $100,000 into as a business.
Oh, yes. Well, that's a good point, though, that when you're a young startup, like bootstrapping or small team, you're probably working more directly with customers, hopefully, right? That you're having people that you can work with, and you're working out those level of issues and of usability and things like that. As it's mature and you're trying to fine tune or just grease it a little bit, then you might get into like A/B testing and how are people using the product? Where are they exiting and entering, and what pages are they transferring from and to, things like that. So I think that's a good point. It's a different level of need, right? Like you're at a different stage in the product's life cycle.
Right. There was a great post. I want to say it was from the CEO of Linear. And one of the things they talked about is how they don't do A/B tests. It's all about taste, which is, okay, I am making a judgment call here that I think this is the right thing for our users because I talk to our users and I use our own product. This is the thing that we're going to move forward with. And then we'll measure that. And if it's not doing well, we'll move back. Whereas I think you can use numbers to justify a lot of things, you know, and finagle things in a way. Don't get me wrong, like having a data focused approach can be a really good thing. But sometimes early on, you don't really have the numbers where you can get a representative sample that's statistically significant all the time. Or you can, but it just might take a long time for it to be statistically significant. Also, knowing that it's statistically significant is actually a challenge in and of itself. And so sometimes just early on, taste is the thing that should be driving the product. Because if you're building a company or the co-founder of the company, I would hope that you are an expert or someone who has kind of thought leading ideas about what is right for users, because you've probably either experienced that pain or you've built products for customers in the space and you know the pain that your customers are experiencing. So taste to me is kind of one of the most important things early on with choosing tools. Like, hey, we're all here because we like Elixir, which I think is a great taste to have.
I like that. I like that framing it as taste. Because if someone is building a company around something because, oh, I think there's a business opportunity here, but I don't actually care about the product, I don't have the taste necessarily to be able to make those decisions. But it's like, oh, this is something I'm passionate about, or it's a product owner and they're passionate about knowing what's the right thing for their set of customers and their market. That's where that taste comes in, which I really like that idea, because it's all these different services, just I've been thinking of products, you know, like that you use just on the web, that they have a different feel to them. And some of them are just going to resonate with you like, wow, I love the feel of this, or the way that social interactions happen on this platform suits me better than this other platform. That's part of that taste.
One thing that I'll say is that maybe I'm off base here, but I think that if you have a data-focused approach, it's going to help you get to a local maximum, but it's not going to help you get to like this revolutionary new maximum that is kind of outside of what you currently see in your vision. And it's only taste that's going to get you from A to B there. There's not going to be any data, and a lot of times that's going to be able to support how to get to this, you know, completely new vision.
So how do you develop your taste?
Well, you screw up a lot. You make a lot of mistakes and you realize what doesn't work. And then you start to get a groove for what does work and what you like.
I got to have groove. Oh, man, I'm in trouble.
Taste is as much about, you know, your experience as it is about confidence and saying, hey, I think this is a good thing. And I think it's a good thing for other people, too. So I think when you pair those things together, hopefully, if you have good taste, you might have bad taste. Other people like what you're building as well.
I agree, though, that trying to focus too much on the numbers kind of thing early in the game is maybe off the mark. I imagine, you know, if I'm starting to create a new service and I'm talking to my customers and I'm hearing from my customers on social media or whatever my main channel of interaction is, and they're telling me my pricing page is confusing, I don't need A/B testing to tell me that my pricing page is confusing, right? I just like let's go fix this. Just fix it and move on.
You can measure that people leave your page really fast, but it's going to tell you the same thing.
I'm reminded of the Steve Jobs quote. I hope, don't let customers tell you what they want. You have to tell the customer, I'm paraphrasing, but they have to tell the customers what they want. That's the counterpoint, I guess, of like, I have to trust my taste in introducing a revolutionary kind of like idea or something.
I think that comes down to understanding what the underlying need is, yeah, but not what the words are that they're asking for. Like, I want a faster horse.
Right.
Famously said by George Washington.
As opposed to like, I want to get from this place to this place faster. Maybe there's other ways we can do that.
Yeah. I can't help but like make the analogy work for food too. You know, like I've got some small children and all they want is mac and cheese or chicken nuggets or something, you know, like, come on, please stop licking the ranch off of your salad. Eat the salad. The analogy there, I guess, being that like to have good taste, you have to be able to try things too and retry things. That's the other part. Mm-hmm. You know, like Dave, you were saying, like, I forgot about AppSignal. I'm gonna think I'm gonna go try it out again, you know, because things do change over time. That it could be, they could have introduced like, you know, some really cool tools, inspire some new ideas. They could have gotten somebody with taste in there, not to say they didn't have taste before, but things change over time. So you got to keep your palate excited, I guess.
Absolutely.
Well, before we run out of time completely, I want to touch on a couple more. So one, I want to hear about any particular email solutions that you found that work really well for like Elixir applications that need to send out emails where you're looking for, you know, high deliverability. What do you use maybe at different scales because there's different pricing and all that? Like, what have you had the best luck with?
Okay, let's talk about two different scenarios because they're fundamentally different. One, I want to talk about, I want to send my user's email for like transactional things like login, right? So setting up magic links. How do you do that? I recently did this for one of our products, Leaderboard TV, and I found that Postmark is a great vendor. They're relatively cheap. I was comparing them with SendGrid, which is well known, but a little bit harder to use. I think a bit more expensive. Postmark has been great. I basically set it up once. I forgot about it. Deliverability seems really excellent, and all their other tools and features are amazing. I don't really have that much to say about them otherwise, but I want to talk about newsletters because David and I worked on a newsletter company together called Milk Road. And I found that, speaking of taste, this company Beehive just does an excellent job of being a one-stop shop, build a newsletter and monetize it, and A/B test and all the things we just talked about all happen on Beehive. They send your emails for you. I think they use SendGrid under the hood. We use this at Milk Road, and I think at least at the time we were one of their biggest clients. That they were pretty recent business. But Tyler, who's the CEO of Beehive, has just done an excellent job of taking that everything that he learned from Morning Brew, which was a company that he was kind of one of the first engineers at and really helped develop the email newsletter marketing tools, basically took all the lessons there and the tools and brought that to this platform. And so I think as engineers, we have this tendency to want to build things ourselves, but this I think is a great example of a tool where if you're trying to build a newsletter, that's probably a great platform to go and get started and to build a huge audience and to just really get pretty far. Somewhat related to email and to newsletters is coming from like the SEO angle of things. I just want to give a quick shout out to two tools. One that I'd never heard of before is Ahrefs. So like, you know, the anchor tag and then href, combine them, Ahrefs. They provide this really interesting tool where you could see all the backlinks to your website, meaning all the places on the internet that link to you and then the traffic that they drive. And if you're playing an SEO game where you're trying to rank higher on Google, those backlinks are really important leading indicator for how much traffic you're going to get. So at Milk Road, we use this extensively for trying to see how we could target different search terms and improve our SEO presence. So that's a really good tool if you're a small business and you're writing blog posts and content or newsletter and you want to boost your search engine rankings. You use this tool to kind of see how you're doing and get kind of that insight. And then the other thing is the Google Search Console, which kind of does this a little bit as well, but it's kind of Google's the authority and you kind of see how you're ranking for different terms over time. this is a really important tool as a modern business to be relevant in Google. And I don't have any help for being relevant in ChatGPT or Perplexity AI or any of those other things.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting thing if people are trying to game being picked up for product recommendations in ChatGPT style LLMs.
We live in the dark timeline.
Yeah.
A shameless self-plug, since you're talking about SEO, there is a library called Phoenix SEO that provides a little framework for your Phoenix application to have a framework for setting your SEO tags for the crawlers. I just updated it with some modern examples. I was still using the Phoenix Route Helper, which has been long dead. The library itself would still work. It was just the examples. Anyway, Phoenix SEO, you can go check that out. It's just a framework for utilizing Elixir protocols, actually, to help populate all those SEO tags for you.
All right. Well, Dave, we are about out of time. But before we go, is there anything else that you've learned along the way in this journey that you've been on, this career path, that you'd want to share with other Elixir professionals coming up behind you?
Read the docs.
RTFM?
I can't believe how many people don't read the docs.
That's your parting word is RTFM.
Yes. It's so funny. I had a tweet about this last week, or maybe it was even yesterday or 2 days ago. I started a company this past year. It's called TV Labs. And what we do is we work with media companies who build streaming television apps. So the apps that run on your smart TV. And we put TVs in your browser. So think of us as the browser stack for televisions, if you remember the browser stack tool, which allowed you to check out different web browsers and interact with IE6 in your Chrome window so that you could test that your application works. So we do the same thing for TVs, where if you want to test your app on a LG or a Samsung or a Fire Stick or an Apple TV, you don't have to have those physical devices next to you. You could check it out on the TV Labs platform, interact with it as if it's right in front of you. You could even reverse proxy the TV onto your local machine and then use the local SDKs to be able to interact, upload builds to the TV. And then we also allow you to write Lua scripts and use a vision-based API for navigating the apps and writing visual assertions. Did this box pop up or is this a loading bar coming onto the screen? And so to build this platform, I'm working with two other technical co-founders who come from a JavaScript background. And because they're so senior and so technical, it took a lot of convincing for them to understand Elixir and kind of get onto the platform. You know, they're smart people. And so they just want to, you know, brute force their way through the problem. I know how to solve this in React. So I want to, you know, go through this way. My CEO, Steven, he had this fundamental shift in understanding because he's like, Dave, like, I understand we're using Live View, but like, I need to update state. Like, I need to have like interactivity on the website. Like, we need to write JavaScript. And I was just like, no, it's not how it works. You just update the state on the server and it will come down. And once he had this mindset shift, it like unlocked everything. And now he's like telling everyone about Elixir and Phoenix and how great it is. And I haven't been able to convince my other co-founder, Thomas, of the good word just yet. But a lot of times, like, they'll run into these issues and they'll be like, I don't know what to do. And ChatGPT isn't telling me the right thing. And I'm like, well, did you read the docs? Because if you did, you would know, find the answer in like 5 seconds. Elixir docs are probably my favorite part about the ecosystem, how everyone just really, who writes libraries, I think really feels the responsibility to write good documentation and to improve it. And it's also the best way to get involved with open source and to add documentation to other libraries. And so make use of that. It's a resource. It's out there. It's free. It's amazing. Read the docs.
Speaking of good taste, you know, Elixir devs just have good taste knowing what the people really want.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
Now we just need an LLM integration.
Exactly. Xdocs has been improving steadily, just continually getting better. So yes, that makes the documentation experience even better. Awesome. Well, thank you, Dave, for coming and talking with us and sharing all these experiences and recommendations and lessons learned. If people want to follow you or get in touch, what is the best way to do that?
So you can follow me on Twitter, DavyDog187. Never going to change my fifth grade username handle. So find me on Twitter. I've tried to use all of the Fediverse stuff, and I still keep coming back to X. I'm sorry, excuse me. I'm on Elixir Slack, DavyDog187, or if you want to see some of the other things I've talked about, DaveLucia.com. I tend to post things there every once in a while.
I appreciate all the things you've given me to think about. I've got some more stuff to do some research on and learn some more tools and think about what's the right thing for me at my stage. And so hopefully you, dear listener, will be able to take some of these lessons and go look up and maybe learn some new things for yourself. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time on Thinking Elixir.